Today's podcast is brought to you by Tape-A-Call, a super valuable tool for journalists and professionals looking to record crystal clear calls on their smartphones. We spoke to the folks over at Tape-A-Call and learned that it's actually the number one business app for the iPhone in over 30 countries. Tape-A-Call lets you easily record your incoming and outgoing calls, as well as share your recordings with colleagues, interviewees, and through social media. It's the perfect tool for recording phone interviews. Tape-A-Call keeps people honest and accountable and ensures that you never miss an important detail for a story. Over 3 million professionals, including local news journalists and even CNN producers, trust Tape-A-Call on a day-to-day basis. Visit tapeacall.com/podcast today and experience the easiest, most reliable, and convenient call recording app available. It's All Journalism listeners can get Tape-A-Call at an exclusive 20% off discount by visiting tapeacall.com/podcast.
Get me a close-up of food because that's important, but you know, let's not do the food porn thing because we want to see the people making the food. We want to see the place. We want to get a sense of place. It's really about community. It's about tradition. It's about culture and how these food places fit into, you know, the wider, you know, the fabric of a city.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell, here with another podcast about digital media and the people who are making it. This time, I'm back in studio. I've got a guest here on a cold Saturday morning here in Northwest Washington, D.C. Joining me is one of the founders of Culinary Backstreets, a travel and dining website. And I'm going to let the gentleman introduce himself because I know that I'm going to screw up his name. So, sir, could you introduce yourself to our reader or our listeners?
Yes. Thanks for having me, Mike. I'm Yigal Schleifer. I'm the editor-in-chief and co-founder of Culinary Backstreets, culinarybackstreets.com. We're a food, travel, and culture website and a sort of hybrid journalism and money-making outfit. I can explain that more.
Journalism and money making. Tell me more.
Yes, it sounds great. Well, a little bit of money. At least that's the idea.
You're also continuing this scam called the internet.
I'll give the background a little bit. About me, I'm a journalist who's been working mostly as a freelancer for 20 something years, based in New York at one point, then went to Istanbul, Turkey. And that's the relevant place for this story. I was there for 8 years between 2002 and 2010, working mostly as a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, as a stringer for the English language service of the German press agency, Deutsche Presse, and freelancing in general, and covering foreign policy, Turkish affairs, doing more, let's say, hard news based out of Istanbul. In 2009, a friend and I, an American who's still there, Ansel Mullins, a writer, we came up with this idea for what was just going to be a fun blog to do about where to eat locally and authentically in Istanbul. That was called Istanbul Eats. And it really was just a blog. Each of us was taking turns. I think each of us was writing once a week about just little holes in the wall that we liked. And the idea was really, it was born out of, we kept getting being frustrated at the articles that we saw, travel articles, mostly in travel sections. People would come to Istanbul and they would keep going to the same old tourist traps, or they would write about these places that we thought were just terrible. Or we kept meeting people who came to Istanbul and were just directed to these bad places and left saying, I didn't eat well, when we knew that it's, you know, one of the most amazing places to eat in the world, and especially if you kind of explore these back streets that we like to do. And I should also say that as a journalist, sort of, I've always used my journalism as an excuse to look for places to eat, you know. So my first job out of journalism school was at the New York Post, actually. I was a general assignment reporter, you know, being sent out to the far reaches of Queens and Brooklyn. And it was always a great excuse to find, you know, oh, you know, Guyanese food, you know, or I don't know, you know, a Senegalese restaurant, you know, and it was great. So I've always had this kind of, you know, I always thought the greatest, you know, sort of side benefit of doing journalism was, you know, finding all these great places to eat. So it was a chance to write about these places that we liked. So that just started off, you know, really as just a blog, you know. That grew. We started doing it regularly. People were really enjoying it. It really filled a void. Nobody was really doing this in Istanbul at that time, in English or in Turkish. Then about a year later, we had enough material for a book. So we approached a local publisher about doing a guidebook, kind of collecting all the material. So we did a guidebook in English, which was then translated also into Turkish. And then somewhere along the way, soon after that, a friend who does food tours in Rome said, you know, you guys should think about doing food tours in Istanbul. And we thought about that. We thought, this is interesting. We met a guide, interesting person who we liked. And the idea was really then, you know, that to take what we were doing, writing about these places that we like, these small traditional food makers, these old school little places, these mom and pop shops, really places that we felt, you know, needed to be written about as a way of preserving them in a certain way, because a lot of them were disappearing, and applying the approach that we were taking in the blog to a food tour. So a narrative-driven food tour, one that's informed sort of by the same journalistic impulses that were informing what we were writing about, but applying that to a food tour. So we developed a route. I think we called it initially, still called that Culinary Secrets of the Old City. It takes you through areas of the old city of Istanbul, but that you wouldn't get to on your own, that the tourists don't go to, and then really getting the stories of the people making the food and the stories of the city, and really learning something through the food. So narrative-driven food tourism or food, you know, culinary travel. And that started growing. So basically, and then in we added another two routes in Istanbul with other guides. And then in 2012, we decided to take this model that was working really nicely in Istanbul and apply it to other places. So then thus was born Culinary Backstreets. And we started off originally in Barcelona, Athens, Shanghai, then Mexico City. Now we're also in Rio. We're in Tokyo, recently Lisbon. We're in Tbilisi, Georgia. And we're applying the same model in each place. We find a local correspondent who's a real enthusiast about the backstreet scene, you know, real, the local and authentic food scene. And we get them to start writing about these places that we feel are important in terms of writing about the people cooking there, preserving traditions. And then once we kind of get going on the ground there, we develop a activity, usually a walk of some kind, a food tour, and they kind of work together. And so, you know, the idea is to really, in a certain way, you know, we have this revenue generating activity that subsidizes what is now at this point a quite robust editorial component. Well, so that's it in a nutshell.
I mean, that's a really neat approach, because you've sort of, one of the things about traveling is, especially somebody who's going to a, you know, a foreign city, a city they've never been to, is they, you know, they want the sense of authenticness.
Right.
And so you've created a tour for them built around food and your own sort of particular philosophy about backstreets.
Now, right.
When you get these freelance reporters into these writers in these cities, what is it you explain to them? You know, what's the pitch? What do you say?
Right,
about
exactly. So we say to them, the first thing I say to them is, this is not about food, but it's about people. And that's really our focus. Our focus is really, you know, and I say this also to the photographers that we work with, is like, don't, you know, I mean, get me a close up of food because that's important, but, you know, let's not do the food porn thing, because we want to see the people making the food. We want to see the place. We want to get a sense of place. It's really about community. It's about tradition. It's about culture and how these food places fit into, you know, the wider, you know, the fabric of a city. So I say this to the writers, too, which is, you know, we're really interested in stories. We're interested in the stories of the people. And we kind of almost see ourselves as almost like oral historians, in a sense of, get the story. You know, let's find out, you know, how, why this place is still around, and who are the people running it, and who are the people coming in. So it's the same that you would say to any journalist, which is, you know, come with your curiosity. You know, come with your kind of sense of enthusiasm, and let's apply it towards getting the full story of a particular, you know, little place, and really get to know the people. I mean, that's really, I keep, you know, kind of keep coming back, but it's the stories of the people. And it's almost like, you know, obviously you want to eat good food and you want to, but it, sometimes, you know, the experience of a place elevates the food in a certain way, right? Around the time that this, the original blog that this came from, Istanbul Eats, got started, I'd done, and one of the things that sort of informed the starting of the blog is I'd gotten an assignment to do a piece for the New York Times travel section, which it was called, they had this feature called High Low, and you'd go to a high place, and then you go to the low place, right? You know, and so I went to this high restaurant in Istanbul of a chef who was working on, he was really had aspirations to kind of make this the first Michelin-starred restaurant in Istanbul. And it was very nice, you know, really nice experience, very good food, you know, very French-influenced. And then the low was this restaurant run by a family from Antakya, which is a city in the south of Turkey near the Syrian border. Food very much influenced by Syrian cooking, you know, more kind of, let's say, Middle Eastern in what people think of Middle Eastern than, let's say, the classic Turkish cuisine, but delicious, you know, great kebabs, great food. And, you know, to me, the experience of the low was so much more fulfilling and satisfying. You know, very good food in the high restaurant, but there was something about the soul and the satisfaction and just the taste of the food in the low that was so great. And I think, you know, so for us, that's very much, we sort of are informed, you know, the work that we do for Culinary Rights is informed about this kind of, you know, exploring that, the low, because I find that there's a lot of, beyond just value, I mean, there's just a lot, so much more satisfaction there in terms of the experience and the, really the experience, I guess, is the way to put it.
Yeah, and the great thing about food is, and looking at a culture or a city from its food perspective, that's food, that's the city, that's it. I mean, that's a slice of their culture.
Right.
You know, that food was created from whatever, you know, from whatever the food, you know, the food that was available around there, the traditions they have in preparation, the, you know, the high, the low, the restaurant, whatever, and who are the skills of the chef. So
yeah.
That gives you something reflective of that community.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things we also kind of in our, let's say, philosophy, as it were, in terms of what we're doing is, you know, kind of in this day or in this age of globalization, you know, there's a lot of sameness globally, right? You there's a Starbucks everywhere and there's, you know, McDonald's, but even like beyond that, I mean, there's a lot of kind of sameness everywhere. So one of the places where you can very quickly access, you know, authentic and authentic, I'm doing air quotes, people can't see that, but authentic is a difficult word. But anyways, you know, right. For lack of a better one, but you know, the quickest way to sort of enter local culture is through food. You know, I mean, there's other ways too, but you know, it takes more time to read books in the original language. You know, you could start reading all of Orhan Pamuk's books to kind of understand Turkey, but it's a lot quicker to, you know, kind of go and do a kebab crawl in a certain neighborhood of Istanbul, where we take people for such, you know, we have an activity like that called a kebab crawl, where we take people to this neighborhood, which is filled with kebab houses of folks from, again, Southeast Turkey, mostly from one particular town called Urfa. And it's a great scene, and you learn a lot about migration in Turkey and you know, the rural migration to the cities, and you learn about the Kurdish issue, and you learn about, you know, Turkish politics, and you learn about, obviously, the food, too. You learn about regional diversity. So, I mean, there's just so much, you know, and it's great. I mean, it's kind of one of my favorite things to do. Likewise, in Barcelona, where we have, you know, both a local correspondence, we also do a few different walks. We do one in a neighborhood called Gracia. Gracia is a neighborhood that a lot of tourists don't get to. It's a little bit off the main tourist scene there, and it has a very strong sense of Catalan identity. So our walk there focuses on the whole idea of Catalan identity and how's that reflected through the food and, you know, more than just food. I mean, so it's, yeah, so the food can tell a lot.
So you've sort of started this out as a blog, and you've sort of grown it into, hooked it up with touring, hooked it up into this website, Cultural Backstreets, sort of
Culinary Backstreets.
But
Cultural Backstreets is good too.
Well, yeah, that's its sister site.
Exactly.
That was not at all a mistake by me. Culinary Backstreets,
right.
and sort of built around this sort of philosophy of getting off the main street of a city and sort of getting into the culture, getting into cuisine of each city. You know, you spent time in Istanbul. What's that cultural story? What's that culinary story there?
Right. So it's a bit of what I just talked about just before. I mean, you get migration is a big story, and that's expressed through the food. You know, Istanbul, for example, you know, you think, oh, kebab. But the truth of the matter is kebab is not an Istanbul food. Kebab is a food from Eastern Turkey, from Southeast Turkey. It came with all, you know, the people who've come to Istanbul over these last couple of decades and made it, you know, this booming city. So it's one story. It's a story of economic change, rapid development. And for example, one of the things we try to do with the blog is, like I said, is kind of preserve, get these oral histories, because the economy is changing so rapidly. There's so much urban development, so much construction. So a lot of these old little places are being displaced, and we're trying to kind of catch them while we can, or maybe bring them a new audience and more customers in a way of kind of holding off their, you know, perhaps inevitable demise, just because this machine of progress keeps rolling along. So it's a story of those things, economic change, migration. It's a story of, in many ways, the divisions, the social, class, political divisions that are very vivid and stark in Turkey kind of get reflected through the food. And just I'll give an example, which is when we started this blog in 2009, like I said before, there was a kind of nobody was doing this kind of thing. And one of the reasons was a lot of the places that we were writing about were, you know, these great, authentic, wonderful places, but they were neighborhoods that are, let's say, more religious, more conservative. And a lot of, you know, middle class secular Turks would just not frequent these neighborhoods. I mean, and the other way around, right? I mean, people just were not going. So, you know, so the Turkish equivalent of slumming it was going to, you know, a conservative, you know, religious neighborhood and eating, you know, in a restaurant that was serving, let's say, the food of people from a particular area in southern Turkey. And that's changed now. I mean, I don't know if that we'd like to think that we had part in that, you know, helped that along. But I think it's changed now in the sense that also people are willing to explore a bit more their own city. So you have these divisions. So, the politics of Turkey were very much reflected in how people ate. Still is.
So with the different cities, the different sites that you're writing about, do you find that, I mean, is your audience primarily travelers or is there a local sort of consumption to you?
It's interesting. I mean, we get a local English speaking. I mean, we're in English. I mean, we're not doing local language sites. So in Istanbul, for example, or in Turkey, we have a very strong local, although, you know, I think a lot of those are expats. I mean, I'm just looking based on traffic, sure. Like, you know, so I can see who's coming from Turkey. Mostly travelers, mostly Americans. That's just seems to be our, you know, our audience right now. But English speakers, Australians, Canadians, from the UK. But in certain places, we found that it does appeal to a local audience. For example, earlier this year or last year in 2015, we started our Georgia, Tbilisi, Georgia section. And I feel like there, for some reason, we're really tapping into a local audience that seems to really, and I think part of it in some places, and I think Istanbul would be included, some places feel, for whatever reason, they feel neglected or they feel like, you know, the outside world is kind of against them or they sort of feel like, hey, we have so much to offer, but no one really knows. You know, in Turkey, I think people rightfully feel like, you know, Turkish cuisine is one of these great world cuisines, right. But it's not as well known as French or Chinese or Italian. I think Georgians feel that way too, and I would agree with them. It's amazing food. It's just a little country. People don't know that much about it. It's obviously always confused with Georgia and the United States. You know, it's hard when your name is Georgia, right?
It's a branding issue.
You know, exactly. So, you know, so there, I think, you know, there's like, and there's interesting things going on there with sort of local folks who are trying to revive, but update the cuisine or promote it. So yeah, it's interesting. In certain places, we're able to tap in a way that into the local audience in a way that is different in other places.
Now, you said that you sort of started out as a, I don't want to say a serious reporter, but a reporter who wrote about serious issues and hard news issues.
Yeah.
Are you surprised that you're writing about food?
Well, no. I mean, like I said, you know, reporting for me has always been the sideline to finding, you know, the next place for lunch. So, you know,
it was part of the scam.
Exactly. You know, like, so, I mean, you know, it's a subject that's always interested me, you know, in the sense of, I feel like I've always brought.
You've been eating for a long time is what you're saying.
I've been eating for a long time, but I feel like, you know, I've always, for example, you know, living in New York, there's so much to explore, right, in terms of where to eat, neighborhoods, types of cuisine. And I feel like I've always brought my skills as a journalist to that activity, right? So, you know, ferreting out places and, you know, on Saturday nights when we were living in New York, you know, my wife and I would just, you know, get in the car and drive out to Queens and go exploring, you know, the back streets there. So it's always, I feel like the same kind of skills of a journalist I would always bring to that cause, you know? And so, and like I said, in the work that we're doing now, we're really trying to make it not just about the food, but really about, you know, that intersection of food and politics, the intersection of food and culture, the intersection of food and history, you know, not just intersections, but sort of how one informs the other, you know, and try to tell these bigger stories. And in many, you know, the cities that we're working in, you know, we kind of have this criteria that we're trying to follow in terms of which cities do we work in, right? So, and we're trying to look at cities that have a great backstory, kind of a underlying tension, maybe is the way to put it, be it economic or political or, you know, in the case of Lisbon, for example, kind of a country that's sort of, you know, a post-colonial power and kind of all the people that come there from these former colonies and economic development. So, you know, kind of underlying tensions, underlying, you know, these kind of big underlying backstories you know, that end up being featured in every one of these food stories because they're really part of what's going on, and the food tells that bigger story. So, you know, so in that sense, it's kind of like, you know, again, the skills of the quote unquote serious journalist are brought to the subject of food, which is actually not such a, doesn't have to be such a light and fluffy thing. It can be a quite serious and significant story.
Well, let's talk about sort of the journalistic aspect of it. Okay. That, you know, travel and food writing, entertainment and living things, you know, this type of writing, you know, a lot of people sort of enter into it as freelancers, build careers out of it. You know, what do you see as a good path to get this type of career?
I mean, you know, I can only speak about my own experience, and it's really comes from a different angle. Yeah. You know,
well,
I mean,
tell us. Yeah.
Well, but you know, I think I would say, you know, if I would kind of zoom out from talking specifically about food and travel and just talking about kind of creating an independent product of your own or independent project. And I think, you know, in today's day and age, we have to talk about an independent brand. But, you know, I think in my own experience, I mean, I've been working mostly as a freelancer. Most of my career was as a freelancer with occasional staff gigs here and there. But one of the things that I saw, and this happened over my time in Istanbul, I got to Istanbul in 2002. So I got there at a time when, as a freelancer, you still had these sort of middle-sized newspapers as potential outlets, right? So I, you know, I did some reporting from Northern Iraq for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. You know, I did some reporting for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, right? I mean, this sounds like, it sounds ridiculous to talk, you know, to talk about that now because it's like that's so far away. But, you know, when I first got there in 2002, you could still pitch editors at these sort of smaller papers for, especially for to do international reporting. And that, you know, as we all know, went pretty quickly, you know, around the time of the Iraq War. I mean, that's a subject for another podcast. You know, what did that war in Iraq do to coverage? Because I think, anyways, the cost of covering that Sure. story was just onerous for these papers. Anyways, but just to say that the outlets, you know, what was out there has really shrunk. On the other hand, what I saw in terms of creating this personal project that evolved into, you know, something much more viable is that the overhead is so much lower, right? Mm-hmm. The cost of entry, the barriers to entry in terms of building something of your own is so much lower. So sometimes we'll get, you know, young journalists will get in touch and sort of want to know about how to get started. And, you know, I often suggest people, you know, if you have an idea of something, you know, it's worth pursuing it now because it's so much more doable in terms of you can set up, you know, a website for almost nothing. And you're in many ways, you can compete with a lot bigger organizations in a way that you could never compete with before because distribution is global now through the web. And, you know, the overhead is so much lower.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I agree also that it has a lot to do with, you know, having some ambition and drive and, you know, developing whatever that brand is, whatever, you know, whatever your passion is and going towards that. I mean, it's clearly that's something that you did is you had a passion for food and, you know, these writing this sort of backstreets cuisine and telling that story from a narrative perspective. And you just went down that path and then, you know, everything has sort of opened up from there. And, that, you know, from my own personal experience, that's what I would say to people is, you know, get that passion. You know, once you feel something passionate about something, then the ability to, you know, as you're saying about barriers, the ability to get that passion out to other people is pretty easy, but you just need to really push yourself and define who you are and what the story you want to tell is.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think I was very lucky in the sense of having, you know, while kind of building, you know, building this side project, which has now become my full-time work, you know, having, you know, other places, you know, to work as a freelancer, you know, I mean, so it's not to make it sound like, oh, just dive right in. I mean,
oh, no.
Right.
It takes time. It takes effort.
Exactly.
Takes money.
Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, that said, it is harder now in the sense because those other outlets that would support you while you're trying to build up your personal project perhaps now are diminished or it's changed, right? I mean,
right.
You know, one of the main, when I was living in Istanbul, one of my main gigs and, you know, probably, you know, more, let's say, generously paying one, or at least, you know, kind of in today's terms, was writing for a website which was funded by the Open Society Institute. So, you know, so the philanthropic, you know, and I think there's so much more of that now in the sense of like philanthropic money being used to pay you know, for journalistic endeavors. Young journalists, you know, I think now are, you know, there's a lot more of that kind of money in journalism versus just going straight to a newspaper, you know, and having them, you know, pay for your assignment. And now people are looking towards foundations. You know, I think other non-governmental organizations are setting up their own kind of journalistic enterprises, and that's a new outlet too. So it's, you know, the outlets have really changed.
Yeah, and sort of the disruption of our industry was, I mean, there used to be a pattern or a track that you followed for your career.
Right.
You get a job at a small newspaper, you get a job at Medium, you work your way up.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you're a columnist, maybe you specialize in something, and then you go off and become a correspondent or about something specific. And I think the path of the freelancer has become more common of, you know, you're not going to be the food editor at, you know, a small paper because the small papers are struggling and they're not paying a lot to sustain a food editor. So if you want to write about food stuff, then you're going to need to, you know, work hard to produce that content, you know, and maybe not get paid for it for a while and then supplement that with some sort of income, whether it's journalistic or non-journalistic. I think it's kind of the model that we have to move forward. One thing I was thinking about when you were talking about Istanbul and everything. I'm imagining a situation where you're traveling from someplace to someplace else, so you end up in Istanbul for a day. What's your culinary journey for a day? Where do you go?
Where do I go for a day?
Yeah, like, I'm going to have a day in Istanbul, so I'm going to get to go eat. Where are you going to go eat?
Oh, God. It's really hard. The nice thing about Istanbul is it's a great walking city. So, I mean, I definitely would start. I would probably spend most of my time in Beyoğlu. Beyoğlu is the neighborhood, sort of the old European quarter, and it's got great back streets, of course, and a great mix of places. It's less about sort of where, and I'd say more of a what, right? So, like, I would start my day very clearly, and there's a few places for this, but in Beyoğlu, there's a little restaurant called Lades 2 that serves kaymak. Kaymak is like a clotted cream sort of thing. It's made from water buffalo milk, and it's this super creamy, white, beautiful
thing. They make mozzarella
thing.
Out of, isn't it?
Well, it's more spreadable. It's really, and it's served with honey on top, and it's incredible. When we wrote about it, we described it as, you know, this is the food, the only food they serve in heaven, and the cafeteria in heaven. You know, it's just like this kind of cloud-like, heavenly, angelic, beautiful thing. So that's, you know, you start your day off with that.
Do you bust your own table in heaven? That's what I want to know. Anyway.
It's just, lunch. Living in Turkey turned me into a fan of liver. I never thought I would say this.
Well, and that's what they say. I hear that a lot about cuisines that are not American.
Yeah.
The sweetbreads.
Yeah.
And things like things, yeah. awful, things yeah, that we yeah, wouldn't
exactly.
normally eat. Are like high art in other places.
High art. So, you know, liver, yeah. So, you know, I to me, liver was always the punchline of a joke, but like, I kind of like it's there. So anyway, so I would go for lunch. There's a few places that do a special kind of liver for lunch. So in Beyoğlu, that particular neighborhood, you would find a great spot for liver, you know, and then a couple of snacks along the way. I'm a big fan of, beyond baklava, one thing, especially maybe this time of year, kind of more like fall into winter, there's a dessert of poached quince. I don't know, it's this incredible thing that's served again with this kaymak, the clotted cream. So that's something that, you know, kind of whenever I get back to Istanbul now, I kind of make a beeline for this one particular place that's in the fish market in this neighborhood, Beyoğlu, that they make this great quince dessert. Yeah, you know, there's some spots for kebab. I mean, you get your pick or, you know, go out for a minute. I mean, it's hard to choose is the problem.
But you have to choose. I've made it.
Yeah, so I would stick in that neighborhood and then make sure I get a day two and then go...
I couldn't get a connecting flight, so
exactly.
I'm gonna have to stay an extra day.
But it's
change
yeah,
the
there's real. I mean, there's just so much to choose from. But there's also you know, this neighborhood that I mentioned before, the kind of more quote unquote conservative neighborhoods. A neighborhood called Fatih has incredible kebab spots. It's got one area that's an old Ottoman, Byzantine, and then Ottoman era market area. It still today serves as a market, and it's got a lot of Kurdish stores all around it. So there's some great food from the east there. Anyways, there's so much to choose from. It's a bit overwhelming, actually.
So we live in a pretty good food city, and there are a couple of pretty good food cities in the United States. And I know that you've got a section of the website that's about Rio. Have you ever thought about doing anything in the Americas?
You know, we talk about it. One of the things that we feel like in terms of our model is that the value added that we bring is we're kind of serve as these guides in cities that are harder to navigate on your own.
Okay.
Either if it's language or geography or culture or, you know, just a tough place to get around
sure.
for whatever reason. So
D.C., New York, and Los Angeles are pretty well covered.
So they're well covered, you know, for our audience, which, like I said, is mostly English speaking, you know, easier to get around. That said, we're about to start a project in Queens. Queens is great. I mean, Queens, New York is, you know, just this incredible.
What's the food to get in Queens?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it could be Thai, Chinese in Flushing. There's incredible Korean. You know,
and things that people probably don't know about,
and things that you know, Queens is amazing. I was looking at a map. It's probably the only place in the world where it was a map of where what languages predominate in different neighborhoods, and it's probably the only place in the world where Tagalog lives side by side by Yiddish. You know, it's like mm-hmm. there's like Yiddish kind of bumping up to the border of Queens, coming up from Greenpoint and Williamsburg, and then there's a Tagalog. Anyways, it's great. It's incredible. So we're going to start a project there, looking at migrant communities.
Sure.
So to us, Queens kind of has some of that quality of what we find in places abroad, in the sense of like a lot of languages, a lot of little neighborhoods, a lot of really interesting little holes in the wall. So we're planting our flag in Queens. But like I said, in many ways, you know, we sort of feel like what we bring to the table works a bit better in a place where it's just harder to get around on your own, and you really need that local friend to show you.
So you say Queens is the next thing. Do you have any other places that you're gonna expand to?
Well, we just got going in Lisbon in terms of doing some coverage there and adding it as a regular section to our site. And we're also developing a walk in Tokyo, which we're really excited about. We have somebody writing for us there, and we're really very excited about it. So those are the big projects we're working on right now.
Okay. So just to sort of wrap things up, I want to talk briefly about Culinary Backstreets as a website, and it's something that you launched pretty much by yourselves, how are you financing? What's the structure?
The structure is like I explained. You know, we have this editorial component, and then we have the, let's say, revenue generating side, which is the food tours. We have some books and we have an app that we've done. Those are, let's say, you know, not as strong as, you know, revenue generators as the tours that we do. So really the model is to have this one component, which is a, you know, more of a tourism business at the end, you know, kind
of at the end of the day,
and then have the editorial component, which is supported by the revenue generating side.
Yeah, and that's really smart, and something people are always, you know, trying to figure out ways to finance a website, you know, online publication, and they're not necessarily thinking about events or services so much.
Right, and I should say that they work hand in hand, because, you know, the editorial that we do helps build our, you know, we feel like helps really establish our street cred.
Sure. You identify the places to go.
But also, you know, on the web, we have a presence as the local, you know, food and restaurant guide to Mexico City, to Istanbul, to Tokyo, you know, so we really get ourselves set up in that way. And we find that brings a lot of people in through the door, you know, to then look at our offerings, you know, the events that we do, the activities that we do. And it also helps us kind of scout out, you know, our people on the ground are sort of scouting out interesting places, and it really helps inform, you know, again, that narrative-driven structure of the food tours that we do. That's very much informed by the journalism that we do, writing about these places. So it really works, you know, hand in hand. And for us, it's been a really positive positive model.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a wonderful sort of approach to, you know, narrative travel reporting. I find it really fascinating and really kind of neat and something I want to really sort of dive into. Because if you're traveling, I mean, you want to experience what the country is.
Exactly. And I would say that along with all the changes in journalism and in the changes in technology that allow you to sort of set up your own site very easily and distribute very easily, you know, there's also been a change in the way people travel. And I think we've been very much the beneficiaries of that, you know, in the sense that people want that authentic experience. People really want to get that very unique local flavor. They want to get very hands-on, maybe. We'll get inquiries from people who are staying in, I don't know, $400 a night hotels in Istanbul, but they're like, take me to that little kebab shack that I saw, you know, on TV on some show or that I heard about, you know. And so it's that high-low again, you know. So they're kind of people who have means and are, you know, can travel, you know, very nicely. On the other hand, want to, you know, not eat at that fancy restaurant in the hotel, but they really want to get that sense of local, real culture. So it's interesting. But I mean, it's not just people with means who are traveling. I think everyone who's traveling now is interested in food and interested in very authentic local experiences.
Yeah, and also you mentioned about the local expats, and they're there for a reason. They want to be there, and they want to find out. They want to have a resource that tells them places they may not know about.
For sure.
Okay.
For sure.
Well, this has been great. I really appreciate you coming in.
It's been a pleasure.
I encourage people to check this out, especially if you're going to go traveling, Culinary Backstreets. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on It's All Journalism, we talk to Steve Lubetkin, co-author of The Business of Podcasting.
It's not about going viral. It's not about having 20 million people. That's the old advertising model. You know, you throw something at the eyeballs or at the ears of 20 million people, and a small percentage of it, we know, it will stick and they will buy the product or service. But that's not really the best use of a podcast. The best use of a podcast is for a very narrow focus, for an audience that lies awake at night trying to solve a problem and Googles that problem and then finds a company with a podcast where their subject matter expert talks about how they can solve that problem. That's where it really becomes effective.
Check back next week for our conversation with Steve Lubetkin about the business of podcasting. You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find out more about us and download past episodes at itsalljournalism.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast and download past episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. This week's podcast was produced by Amber Healy, Michael O'Connell, and Nicole Agrisco. It's All Journalism is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast is brought to you by Tape-A-Call, a super valuable tool for journalists and professionals looking to record crystal clear calls on their smartphones. We spoke to the folks over at Tape-A-Call and learned that it's actually the number one business app for the iPhone in over 30 countries. Tape-A-Call lets you easily record your incoming and outgoing calls, as well as share your recordings with colleagues, interviewees, and through social media. It's the perfect tool for recording phone interviews. Tape-A-Call keeps people honest and accountable and ensures that you never miss an important detail for a story. Over 3 million professionals, including local news journalists and even CNN producers, trust Tape-A-Call on a day-to-day basis. Visit tapeacall.com/podcast today and experience the easiest, most reliable, and convenient call recording app available. It's All Journalism listeners can get Tape-A-Call at an exclusive 20% off discount by visiting tapeacall.com/podcast.